His final argument, both to his miserable comforters, pleading his innocence and also pleading with God all at the same time. And so he has, in those verses 21 through 25, as we finished verse 29, or chapter 29, you know, he's talking about the kind of influence he had before his, you know, this wave after wave of disaster came upon him. And it was a culture that he lived in that's very different from our culture. It's a culture that was one where authority was respected, again, quite forcefully, in that later on through the law of Moses, for a child to be disrespectful towards authority was a simple thing to be handled by the village. You know, it takes a village to raise a child, we're told these days. Well, in that day, disobedience on the part of a child meant that the village would gather together and stone the child. Now, you know, you may or may not like that, you know, but, you know, it had to make a dent on the juvenile delinquency of the day. But you weren't disrespectful towards authority. And for him to have the place of preeminence, really, his word waited upon. Everyone else hushed as he would speak. And it didn't produce an arrogance within his life. Oh yes, here I come. Everyone ought to be quiet. It was just a thing of when, why talk? Because whatever we say is going to look lame to whatever this guy ends up saying. And when he says something, the dispute is settled. The argument is settled. You ever been in a conversation like that where, you know, we've waxed eloquent as it relates to what we think and, you know, all this and blah, blah, blah and everything. And then there's some guy that just sits quietly the whole time. And then finally he speaks or she speaks. And then we wished we'd have never opened our mouths. So lame was it what we spoke. Well, that was the way that it was with Job. And no arrogance with it. It was just the kind of gifting that he had, the wisdom that he had. And now in his humble position, he's no longer able to, you know, comfort the mourners. But he said, it's even worse than that. It's even worse than the lack of respect I receive. He said, but now they mock at me. Those who formerly received his instruction, those he had formerly helped, he said, now they mock at me. Now, you know, mock's an easy word to read and an easy word to pass over. But you think about it. Think about the last time you were mocked. Some of us have to think back very far to the last time we were mocked. Nobody likes to be mocked. And this became his daily portion. And not from, you know, the highest within society. Now they mock me, he said, men younger than I, whose fathers I disdained to put with the dogs of my flock. I didn't even put them over, you know, the best of my material wealth. I wouldn't even put them over the dogs, let alone the flocks. And indeed, what profit is the strength of their hands to me? They're men who were physically weak. They were valueless, and now they mock me. Their vigor has perished. They're gaunt from want and famine, fleeing late to the wilderness, desolate and waste, who pluck mallow by the bushes and broom tree roots for their food. In other words, that was the kind of stuff that you only ate under extreme pressure. In other words, these were the people that everyone else drove off. They were the weaker kind of person. And so, and you know, usually the, you know, problems within the society. These were the people that nobody else could stand, and they would be driven off into the wilderness. And Job says, now even these people, they mock me and they make fun of me. And he said, they're driven out from among men. They shouted at them as a thief. In other words, men that couldn't be trusted, unwanted men, now mock me. They had to live in the clefts of the valleys, in caves of the earth and the rocks. Among the bushes they brayed, and under the nettles they nestled. In other words, they lived like donkeys. And they're the sons of fools. In other words, the idea is They're not very smart either. It's like, you know, you just take a whole group of fools and you inbreed them, and what do you get? You get a bunch of fools. And he said, this is what these guys are. And yet now they mock me. And it's just, again, a book of poetry. And so poetic ways of putting how low he had gone and what these people, everyone was saying about him. You know, somebody giving you a bad time, you know, saying some things behind you, this puts it all in perspective, doesn't it? He says, they're the sons of fools, yes, the sons of vile men. They were scourged from the land. And now he talks about what these same men, not just what they said to him, but what they did to him. Now I am their taunting song. They've made up songs about me. Yes, I'm their byword. In other words, when they want to talk about, you know, want to call someone a bad name, they begin to call them a Job. That's, you know, nobody likes to have their name used that way. They abhor me. They keep far from me. And then Job says, they do not hesitate to spit in my face. Now, I have never had anyone spit in my face. I would pray for the grace of God to be upon my life at that moment, and that I wasn't armed in any way, that I was very current in my relationship with the Lord, had been a lengthy time of devotion with the Lord that morning. You think about that. When somebody spits in your face, nothing worse virtually that you could do. In this culture, but in that culture, it was even worse. That was the most degrading thing that you could have happened to you. It was the greatest insult. When words would cease and they would say, words of my contempt for you can't even be captured in words. It can only be captured in this. And then they spit in your face. Now, the lowest of the low were doing this to Job. And Job said, this is my portion now. This is what they say to me. This is what they do to me. That's a tough place to be, isn't it? Especially when you're a righteous man like Job was. There was no reason for that to happen to him. There was no, you know, reason as it relates to sin for him to be in the place that he was in. And you look at that and say, man, could anything be worse than being Job and having these kinds of people spit in your face? And there's only one thing that can be worse, and that's to be the Son of God and have humanity spit in your face on the way to the cross, on the way to dying for them. And that's what happened. And apart from the work of grace by God's Holy Spirit in all of our lives, we have the capacity to do it, to join the crowd, to join the mocking, to join the spitting on that day 2,000 years ago. And Jesus, by the time he went to that cross, not only had his back laid wide open by the scourging, not only had the crown of thorns put on his head, blood everywhere. It was a picture of when they took and they slew the Passover lamb, and as they would slay that lamb, and then that blood would be applied. In the slaying of those lambs there at the tabernacle or there at the temple, there was blood everywhere. Blood everywhere. They would take and lay... You would lay your hands on your sacrifice for your sin offering, and then while your hands were on the head of that lamb, they would cut the lamb's throat, and you would feel the lamb begin to buckle and tremble under your hands. The innocent dying for the guilty in order to provide a covering for our sin. And then the blood would be taken and it would be sprayed all over the place, sprayed on you. Blood everywhere on that scene. Why? To give us a picture of the cross. And the Lamb of God on that cross 2,000 years ago was not the sanitary pictures that we see in the famous museums of the world. He is a mangled mess. Blood everywhere. And yet worse than that was, by the time he got to that cross, he was covered with the spit of men. What humility. What humility, what love. God demonstrated his love toward us. But while we were yet sinners, Christ died for the ungodly. What a low place our Lord Jesus took in order to provide a salvation for us, knowing that there would be some who would listen to his message, receive his good news, and walk with him, and walk with him forever. And so, as bad as it was for Job, it was a picture of something much worse that was going to come related to the Son of God. What a great Lord we serve. Verse 11, because he has loosed my bowstring, speaking of God, and afflicted me, he's removed my ability to defend myself. A bowstring was the means by which you could shoot back, you could fight back, and yet God left him now so weak, so debilitated that he couldn't even fight back. And so God has left me in this place. He's afflicted me. They have cast off restraint before me. They don't respect me at all. And at my right hand, the rabble arises and they push away my feet. When I try and walk, they trip me up. They raise against me their ways of destruction. They break up my path and they promote my calamity. They try to break up my progress, and they have no helper. And they come as broad breakers, speaking of big waves. Under the ruinous storm, they roll along. It's not just one or two of them. It's the idea of a canal breaking, and then the water breaking through, or a dam breaking, and then the water heading through. He said, it's not an isolated incident, what's happening to me with these people. There's a flood of them that do this to me every day, is what he's describing. Terrors are turned upon me. They pursue my honor as the wind, and my prosperity has passed like a cloud. They make my life miserable for me. And now my soul is poured out because of my plight. He describes the emotional agony that he's going through, the physical agony of the trial. The days of affliction, they take hold of me. My bones are pierced in me at night. And so he says, let me give you an idea of what it's like to sleep in my condition. It's like my bones are stabbing me all night long. And again, for the person, the chronically ill, with that pain, there's no relenting, there's no freedom from it. And that's where he was at. My bones are doing this to me, and my gnawing pains take no rest. Day and night, I'm in pain. By great force, my garment is disfigured. It binds me, my cloak, it binds me about as the collar of my coat. And what he's talking about, you remember, the skin condition that he has is he's covered from the top of his head to the bottom of his feet with boils. And again, I don't know, If some of us in the room may never have had a single boil in your life. And so, hard to understand it. But for those who've had at least one, there's the understanding of having it from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet, and these boils were continually oozing. And he's saying, listen, my clothes become like a straitjacket to me, because as my sores ooze into the cloth, and then they dry, and they dry to my skin, and then I go to move, and I can't move because now they're attached to my skin, and they, strangle me even in the movement. I mean, he's just really in a tough, tough place. And he said in verse 19, he has cast me, God has, into the mire, the lowest place, and I've become like dust and ashes, that is, like garbage. He cries out to God now in verse 20, and he says, I cry out to you, but you don't answer me. I stand up, in other words, I stand up in prayer. I lift my hands to you, but you don't regard me. I know you see me. I know you hear me, but you don't do anything for me. But you have become cruel to me, Job said. With the strength of your hand, you oppose me. You lift me up to the wind and cause me to ride on. He says, you've made me like a feather in the wind. You throw it and the feather just goes all this way and that. He says, that's the way you're doing to me in my life. You spoil my success, for I know that you will bring me to death and to the house appointed for all that live, or all the living, that is, the grave. Now, he's absolutely wrong in all of this, but this is how he feels in the middle of his trial. He said, surely God would not stretch out his hand against a heap of ruins if they cry out when he destroys it. In other words, the point that he's making here is, God has been worse to me than I have ever been to any human being. And it's hard when we find ourselves in trials, where the difficulty is greater in our lives than we have ever created for another person. And that creates a struggle of its own kind. And so he's looking and saying, God, I would never do to anyone what you are doing to me. I don't understand it. I know you're higher than me, but I don't know why you would do this. He said in verse 25, have I not wept for him who was in trouble? Has not my soul grieved for the poor? But when I looked for good, evil came to me. When I looked and when I waited for light, then came darkness. My heart is in turmoil and cannot rest. Days of affliction confront me, and I go about mourning, but not in the sun. In other words, he's talking about the fact that his skin has become blackened. Black was in that day as it is today, it is the color of mourning. And so he's saying, my skin has turned black. It's turned the color of mourning, but not because I've been sitting out in the sun because of my disease. He said, I stand up in the congregation. I cry out for help, but nobody helps me. He's saying, where are all the people that I helped? Where are all the people that I helped now that I need help? We understand all of these emotions, don't we? I'm the brother of jackals and the companion of ostriches. And both jackals and ostriches are known for making a pathetic kind of cry. And he said, that's what I sound like. My skin grows black and then it falls from me. My bones, they burn with fever. So you imagine the pain there. My harp is turned to mourning instead of rejoicing, and my flute to the voice of those who weep. Chapter 31. He said, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? Job now makes his final defense against the accusation that's made against him. The accusations that's been made against him by his friends are this, that he's wicked, that he's in the condition that he's in because of sin in his life. And he's going to go right through the laundry list, and he's going to say, I am not guilty of this. I am not guilty of this. I am not guilty of what you accuse me of being guilty of. I am not in this trial. I am not in this situation because of willful sin in my life. And so he says, I've made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman? In other words, he says, I haven't been one who lusted. I don't lust after young women. And it's interesting, the key for him as it related to dealing with that is, he said, I made a covenant with my eyes. And that's not a bad thing to do. Lord, I give you my eyes this morning as I head out into the day. They're all yours. And the Lord will be faithful to remind you that you've given him your eyes during the course of the day. He said, for what is the allotment of God from above and the inheritance of the Almighty from on high? Is it not destruction for the wicked and disaster for the workers of iniquity? Does he not see my ways and count all my steps? In other words, he's saying, God knows that what I'm saying is true. He said, if I've walked with falsehood, or if my foot has hastened to deceit, let me be weighed in a just balance, that God may know my integrity. If my step has turned from the way, or my heart walked after my eyes, or if any spot, that is willful sin, adheres to my hands, then let me sow and another reap. Let me another eat. In other words, let me lose everything. Yes, let my harvest be rooted out. In other words, he says, I haven't lived a life of deceit. I haven't lived a life of lying and falsehood. And then in verse 9, he tells us that he hasn't committed adultery. He said, if my heart has been enticed by a woman, or if I've lurked at my neighbor's door, then let my wife grind for another. Let her become a servant, and let others bow down over her. For that would be wickedness, speaking of adultery. Yes, it would be iniquity, worthy of judgment. So, and for that would be a fire that consumes to destruction and would root out all of my increase. He said, if I had engaged in adultery, then it would be at the risk of everything that I have. But he said, I haven't done it. He now tells us that he hasn't been insensitive to the, you know, needs of those who are powerless. He said, if I've despised the cause of my maidservant or my manservant, when they complained against me, what then shall I do when God rises up? When he punishes, how shall I answer him? Did not he, God, who made me in the womb, make them? And did not the same one fashion us in the womb? And so Job was a very commendable man. He looked and said, I don't know why I have the position that I have. I don't know why I'm the most powerful man in my day in this part of the world. I don't know why I have the power that I have. I don't know why I have the possessions that I have, the influence that I have, the wealth that I have, because I'm no different from anybody else. And with that understanding, he realized that he wasn't better than anyone else. He was different. And so he used his position, he used his power to then plead the case of those who had less power. And that's a wonderful thing in our lives today. We live in a day in the United States of America where everyone's in a panic over their piece of the economic pie. And is this group going to be the one that'll steal from us? And if we let too many of these in, or this or that, and all of this kind of thing that can have, you know, greed and selfism as its base in that, and we begin to think that God has given us the positions that he's given us in order that it might all be for the benefit of us. But he puts us in these positions in order that we might use that influence or that power or that wealth or whatever it might be to help others who have less, and to recognize that. It's a wonderful way to live. I think that in many respects, though I disagree, you know, virtually completely with the doctrines of the Roman Catholic Church, I think that so much as it relates to them in terms of taking up the cause of the poor, taking up the cause of the powerless, I'm very concerned that the body of Christ in the United States of America is now very close to being identified as a political movement rather than a spiritual movement. And, you know, we align with these agendas. And yes, there's a concern as it relates to, you know, personal responsibility. We see the revamping of welfare, these things. Hey, a failure for there to be personal responsibility, that doesn't produce what's best in human beings. But at the same time, we have a responsibility as Christians to take up the cause of the powerless, to take up the cause of the poor. That's one of the reasons, that's one of the things that God uses us for. And so we see the great clamor today. If I can, not dealing with it on a political issue, but as a kingdom of God issue, we see the shifting in terms of responsibility for this or that, in terms of a safety net related to society from the federal government to the states. I'll be glad when it shifts from the states to the people. Too long, we as Christians have had to compete with the federal government as it relates to helping meet people's needs. There's no way we can dash out checks the way that they can. But here as we look and they say, what's going to happen? Where's the safety net going to be? And Christians involved in all of this. What's going to happen to this poor and to this situation and that situation? That's one of the things that we're here for. That's one of the things that we're here for. So that we take and we look and we say, listen, there is someone that's in need. There's someone that needs their cause to be pled in this situation. There's someone that I can help out. This is a responsibility of humanity and individual human beings and Christians. And he saw it that way. He saw it that way. We're all the same. I'm not better for what I have or the power that I have. I have it for God's purposes to be used for more than just bringing wealth to myself. Verse 16, if I have, you know, and I haven't watched any television news it home in months. You imagine how you got going off on this now. I'm fairly weaned from the news, except for that most reliable of all sources for objective news, the newspaper. So, God bless you if you work for the newspaper, but we have, I forget it, I'm not saying another word. Verse 16, if I have kept the poor from their desire, and what's the desire of the poor? Food and clothing. Or cause the eyes of the widow to fail, in other words, without any hope. Or eaten my morsel by myself so that the fatherless may not eat of it. I accumulate all and I just kind of eat in secret so nobody, you know, and don't put any of those poor people in front of me to make me feel bad. Kind of, he didn't do any of that. He said, but from my youth I reared him as a father, speaking of the fatherless. And from my mother's womb, I've guided the widow. If I have seen anyone perish for lack of clothing, or if any poor man, or any poor man without covering, if his heart has not blessed me, that is with thanksgiving for being given something by Job, and if he was not warmed with the fleece of my sheep, if I have raised my hand against the fatherless, oppressed them, then when I saw I had help in the gate, in other words, I had the power to help, then let my arm fall from my shoulder and let my arm be torn from the socket, for destruction from God is a terror to me, and because of His magnificence, I could not endure. And he says, I couldn't, you know, not have anything to do with those who are less fortunate because I have the fear of God within my life, but I also have seen and tasted of His magnificence directed towards me. He's been good to me, and that causes me to be good to others. Verse 24, if I have made gold my hope, or said to fine gold, you are my confidence, if I've rejoiced because of my wealth was great, in other words, if I've trusted in gold rather than in God, he said, and because my hand has gained much, if I've observed the sun when it shines, you know, the sun worship, or the moon moving in brightness, worship of the moon, so that my heart has been secretly enticed and my mouth has kissed my hand, this also would be an iniquity worthy of judgment, for I would have denied God who is above. If I have rejoiced in the destruction of him who even hated me, or lifted myself up when evil found him. He says, I haven't rejoiced in the destruction of my enemies. Indeed, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for a curse on his soul. If the men of my tent have not said, who is there that has not been satisfied with meat? But no sojourner had to lodge in the street, for I opened my doors to the traveler. If I've covered my transgressions as Adam by hiding my iniquity in my bosom, because I feared the great multitude and dreaded the contempt of families, so that I kept silence and did not go out of the door. Oh, that I had one to hear me. He's saying, would somebody listen to me? God or man, would somebody listen to me? Here is my mark. This is my defense. I'm resting my case. Oh, that the Almighty would hear me, that my prosecutor, speaking of God, had written a book. Oh, I wish he would make his charges as clear towards me as writing it in a book. Surely I would carry that book of charges against me on my shoulder, and I would bind it like a crown. In other words, I would listen to it. I would give honor to what God would say to me as it relates to a charge. I would declare to him the number of my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. In other words, I would take my punishment like a man if I just knew why it was that I was in what I've done. What have I done? And if I deserve punishment, I'll take it like a prince. I'll take it like a man. God, just let me know. If my land cries out against me because, you know, I've stolen it from someone, and its furrows weep together because of the person that I stole it from, if I have eaten its fruit without money, or caused its owners to lose their lives or lose their livelihood, then let thistles grow instead of wheat, the wheat and weeds instead of barley. The words of Job are ended. And so Job, it took him a little while to finish, you know, saying what he wanted to say, but, you know, he finally got to it. So he's done talking. And just when you think, all right, the three comforters have stopped talking, Job has stopped talking, good, let's hear what God has to say. There's a whippersnapper in the crowd, and he is full of himself, and he has a lot of things that he wants to say. And so Elihu, he comes forth now to bring forth his case. He's going to, you know, teach everyone about what's going on. He said, and so these three men, the comforters, ceased answering Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. They looked at Job and said, man, if we haven't convinced him yet, then there's no convincing this guy. They ran out of arguments, and so they were silenced too. And then the wrath of Elihu, the son of this guy, the Buzite, of the family of Ram. So it gives us all of these, you know, the lineage here, because nobody knows who he is, and we need all of that to know who he is. The wrath of Elihu, was aroused against Job. And his wrath was aroused against Job because Job justified himself rather than God. His complaint against Job was, Job, and everything you're saying, you're making yourself look good and you're making God look bad in all of this. And he was also, his wrath was aroused against Job's three friends because they had found no answer and yet had condemned Job. He had listened to what the charges that they had brought against Job, and they came to nothing, and yet they condemned Job based upon these, you know, flimsy kind of arguments that they had raised. And so Elihu is all upset with them. Verse 4, now because they were years older than he, Elihu had waited to speak to Job. And so he's a younger man, and so he was respectful towards age. He politely waited to bring forth his arguments, but politeness is going to be out the window in just a moment. When Elihu saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, his wrath was aroused. He is very, very upset at these three, and now he's going to express his disappointment towards these three. Elihu answered, and he said, I'm young in years, and you are very old. Now, earlier, it's just been, they've been old, but to youth, above a certain age is very old. Isn't it true that sometimes when you're in elementary school and you have a teacher and it just seems like they're ancient, and then you meet them when you graduate from high school and they look the same and you thought surely they'd be in the grave by then? You know, everything looks old when you're young. And so here he's speaking and he says, I'm young in years and you are very old. Therefore, I was afraid and I dared not declare my opinion to you. Now, that is the way of youth. Not in this culture so much. Wish it was more the case. But worldwide and typically through history, the way of youth is that they have typically been intimidated in expressing their opinions in the environment of those who are older. Now, in this culture, the older represented the establishment. They represented the people who held all of the power, the people who decided what was right and what was wrong and what was the right way and what was the wrong way. There was a tremendous concentration of power as it related to the older, and especially the older men within a family. And so the younger didn't often speak their opinions in the presence of the older. And so he said, I didn't, you know, say much. I didn't want to say anything out of respect for your age. He said in verse 7, I said, age should speak, and the multitude of years should speak wisdom. And so that respect for the multitude of years. And he said, but there is a spirit in man, And the breath of the Almighty gives him understanding. He says, great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. And that's the truth. Job is saying just very, very simply, older men are not always wise, and older men do not always understand justice. And it's important for youth to understand that. Important to understand that. Be respectful in your understanding of that, but understand that. There's nothing wrong with testing the ways of this world. There's nothing wrong with testing the ideas of this world. As a Christian, you must do it. And you must not only do it as it relates to the things of this world, but you must do it in spiritual circles. You must ask, where is that in the Bible? Why do you do those things? Just because something has existed forever, or just because something has been in place forever, doesn't mean it's wise. And it doesn't mean that justice flows forth from it. There are many, many parts of visual or professing Christianity that is absolutely dominated by those who are not wise and don't know justice. And that should be revolted against in my own personal life. And there's nothing wrong with saying, I don't have time for the aggravation or time to give myself to that. I'm going to move to what the Bible says defines as being wise. You can waste your whole lives accepting other men's definitions of what is wise and what is just. And so there's nothing wrong at all with challenging these things. Learn what we can, you know, learn what you can from what's been in place for a while, but don't be afraid to challenge it, but based upon the Word of God. And so he had some revelation. Great men are not always wise, nor do the aged always understand justice. Therefore I say, he says, listen to me, and I will declare my opinion. Oh great, we need another opinion. Indeed, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasonings while you searched out what to say. I listened to what you said. I listened to you form your arguments. I was very, very patient in listening to you. I paid close attention to you, and surely not one of you convinced Job or answered his words. You guys talked for chapters and chapters and chapters, and you never addressed the questions that Job raised to you. It was like a press conference. So, you never answered his words. Verse 13, and he said, I'm telling you this, lest you say, we have found wisdom. God will vanquish him, not man. In other words, Elihu is saying here, listen, I'm only telling you this so that you don't walk away here thinking that you did something good or you did something right or that your arguments were right. Now, so far he's doing all right, because that's not bad. Even as Christians, we have to be careful. When we find ourselves in the positions of Job's comforters, we can begin to think that we're right and Job is wrong, or whoever it is that we're dealing with is wrong, because we find two other people who agree with us, our thesis, our position. That doesn't mean that we're right. Doesn't mean that we're right at all. And yet there's a great tendency. I must be right because, you know, this guy believes the same thing and this person does, and I respect them both. Everyone can be wrong. Everyone can be wrong. All three of those comforters were wrong. And so he said, I don't want you to think to say, we have found wisdom. God will vanquish Job, not man. In other words, if Job is going to be defeated, he's not going to be defeated by those lousy arguments you guys came up with. It'll have to be God. Verse 14, now he has not directed his words against me. In other words, Job has no resentment towards me, and so I will not answer him with your words. I'm going to bring forth some fresh arguments now, not, you know, your lame arguments that didn't accomplish anything. They are dismayed and answer no more. Elihu now, you know, talks about the emotions of what he felt as these three men were bringing forth their arguments, all that was churning within him. And this is where he kind of gets into trouble. He said, "They are dismayed and they answer no more." Now these three silenced. "Words escape them. They don't have anything else to say. And I have waited because they did not speak, because they stood still and answered no more. I also will answer my part. I too will declare my opinion, for I am full of words." Great! "The spirit within me compels me. Indeed, my belly is like wine that has no vent." And so when they would take that new wine and put it in the wineskins, as it would ferment, there would be a gas produced. It would stretch out the wineskins. He says, "I've been listening to you and I have been about to explode the whole time that you guys have been talking." Ever felt that way? Ever had someone feel that way when you? Well, anyway, yeah. He said, "I was ready to burst like new wineskins." He said, "I will speak that I may find relief." We all recognize that. "I must open my lips and answer. Let me not, I pray, show partiality to anyone, nor let me flatter any man, for I do not know how to flatter, else my Maker would soon take me away." And so, is that the extent of your wisdom? Oh, move over, gentlemen. Now you're going to hear wisdom. Chapter 33. "But please, Job, hear my speech." And now Elihu is going to introduce himself to Job. "Hear my speech and listen to all my words. Now I open my mouth, my tongue speaks in my mouth, my words come from my upright heart." Are we ever going to get to, and "my lips utter pure knowledge, and the Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life." In other words, I am what I am by the grace of God, the great order and great, bastion of wisdom and, fermenting wisdom within me. "If you can answer me, set your words in order before me. Correct me if I'm wrong, Job. Take your stand. Truly I am as your spokesman before God. I also have been formed out of the clay. Surely no fear of me will terrify you." I have no intentions to terrify you, Job, "nor will my hand be heavy on you. I'm not going to beat you down. Surely you have spoken in my hearing, and I have heard the sound of your words saying, I am pure, without transgression. I'm innocent, and there is no iniquity in me." And so he summarizes Job's argument here, that Job was pure, without transgression, innocent, and without iniquity. "And yet God finds occasions against me. He counts me as his enemy. He puts my feet in the stocks. He's got me all blocked up, and he watches all of my paths. He's watching me suffer, and he doesn't have, it doesn't do anything for me." Job, you have, represented yourself as blameless and pure and innocent, without iniquity, and then you have represented God as being against you for some reason. Verse 12, "Look, in this you are not righteous, and I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend with God? For he does not give an accounting of any of his words, for God may speak in one way or another." And what Elihu is going to bring forth here is that God is so much greater than man, that he speaks in a lot of different ways, a lot of different ways that we don't understand. And so how can you, call God to speak to you when he's speaking, maybe speaking, and you don't even hear what he's saying because of the great gulf between, the infinite and the finite? And he begins to speak of ways that God speaks. One of the ways is in dreams, verse 15, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men, while slumbering on their beds, when he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction in order to turn man from his deed and conceal pride from man. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from perishing by the sword. In other words, God delivers men, and delivers them oftentimes through the use of dreams, has done it throughout history. And then he talks about how God can speak to us through suffering. Verse 19, man is also chastened with pain on his bed and with strong pain in many of his bones, so that his life abhors bread and his soul succulent food. His flesh wastes away from sight, and his bones stick out, which once were not seen. Yes, his soul draws near to the pit, and his life to the executioners. In other words, God uses suffering many times to speak to people and to direct them. He says in verse 23 that sometimes he'll use the ministry of a mediating angel. He said, if there is a messenger for him, a mediator, one among a thousand, to show man his uprightness, then God is gracious to him and says, deliver him from going down to the pit, for I have found a ransom. And so God, all through, you know, the Old Testament, and also in the times of Job, it was apparently well known that sometimes God would send an angel in order to, a ministering spirit in order to communicate to man. We have a beautiful picture of, you know, the angel of the Lord, Jesus himself, you know, pictured there in verse 24, when it talks about the graciousness of God, and then speaking of the words of deliverance, deliver him from going down to the pit, I have found a ransom. And this is what Jesus has done for us. He's delivered us from going down to the pit. Why? Because God found a ransom in his Son. Jesus is both the deliverer and the ransom in our lives. And then fascinating, the very first section of the first line of verse 25, and for the person who's been delivered from the pit and who has been delivered by way of ransom, his flesh shall be like a child's. In other words, when this happens, it'll be like a new birth. And so, you know, a little shadow of what would come through the Lord Jesus. His flesh shall be like a child's. He shall return to the days of his youth. He shall pray to God, and he will delight in him, for he shall see his face with joy, for he restores to man his righteousness, and he looks at men and says, I have sinned and perverted what is right, and it did not profit me. He will redeem his soul from going down to the pit, and his life shall see the light. Behold, God works all these things, twice in fact, three times with a man, to bring back his soul from the pit, that he may be enlightened with the light of life. Give ear, Job, listen to me, and I will speak. If you have anything to say, answer me. Speak, for I desire to justify you. If not, listen to me, hold your peace, and I will teach you wisdom. Could we cut out these introductions and these conclusions that you have, Elihu, and then could you continue with your substance? But anyway, I mean, all of this, you know, ideas of his own grandeur. Chapter 34, Elihu further answered and said, hear my words, you wise men. Give ear to me, you who have knowledge. For the ear tests words as the palate tastes food. Just as you taste of savory meal, you run it around in your mouth through the completeness of your palate. You eat your food with discernment. Listen to these sumptuous verbal meal that I'm about to present to you. So sumptuous, don't eat it quickly as a dog would eat its food, but eat it slowly, enjoying all of the small nuances and the smallest of, you know, tastes that are in there, and, you know, give me a break. Let us choose justice for ourselves. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job has said, I am righteous, but God has taken away my justice. Should I lie concerning my right? My wound is incurable, though I am without willful sin. What man is like Job, Elihu says, and now so much for I'm all for you and I'm not going to beat you up. What man is like Job, who drinks scorn like water, can't get enough, who goes in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men, for he has said, it profits a man nothing that he should delight in God. Now, Job never said that, but
That's the way it is sometimes. What you say gets misrepresented. In fact, quite regularly. Verse 10. Therefore, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness and from the Almighty to commit iniquity, for He repays according to man's work and makes man to find a reward according to his way. He's bringing forth the justice of God. God is always just, he's saying. And God is just, and because He is just, He only gives to man what man deserves, whether that be good or whether that be evil. Now, the problem with his argument is this. God is just, but that is not all that God is. He is also gracious, and He is also loving. And I don't think that His justice is mutually exclusive as it relates to love. His justice is an expression of His love. But this guy gets off the justice of God, great. But you have to take the totality of who God is, otherwise you're going to end up out in left field. And so often, even in our own handling of the Scriptures, we all have our little pet subjects. And that's one of the great things about just heading right through the Scriptures. I can't teach all my pet subjects and go to it every week and, you know, pound on those things. And it keeps us with a balanced view of who God is and His ways. So He's going to bring forth the justice, but that's not all that God is. God is more than simply just, as glorious as that is. But most err, you know, in terms of teaching concerning God, is a over-examination of one of His characteristics to the neglect of others. And that's where so much of the false emphasis has come forth from. He said in verse 12, surely God will never do iniquity or wickedly, nor will the Almighty pervert justice. Who gave Him charge over the earth? Or who appointed Him over the whole world? If He should set His heart on it, if He should gather to Himself His spirit and His breath, all flesh would perish together, and man would return to dust. If you have understanding, hear this. Listen to the sound of my words. Now, when a preacher has to say that over and over again, it's usually an indication that he's losing his audience. Now, hear this. It's a perverse pastor humor. But anyway, I know we're at about 51 minutes as it relates to heading through this, but the fact of the matter is when you got to repeat yourself over and over again like that, like he's doing, eyes are rolling, you know, and all of that. And so he's trying to keep them there. Listen to the sound of my words. Should one who hates justice govern? Will you condemn him who is most just? Is it fitting to say to a king, you are worthless, and to nobles, you are wicked? Yet He is not partial to princes, God isn't, nor does He regard the rich more than the poor, for they are all the work of His hands. In a moment they die, in the middle of the night, the people are shaken and pass away, the mighty are taken away without a hand. And so he's saying, Job, all of this has happened to you because of your wickedness. For His eyes are on the ways of man, and He sees all of man's steps. There is no darkness nor shadow of death where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. Job, you're a worker of iniquity. For he need not further consider a man than that he should go before God in judgment. He breaks in pieces mighty men without inquiry, and sets others in their place. Therefore He knows their works. He overthrows them in the night, and they are crushed. He strikes them as wicked men in the open sight of others, because they turn their back from Him. In other words, Job, you're in the problem that you're in because of your iniquity and because of your rebellion against God, and would not consider any of God's ways, so that they cause the cry of the poor to come to Him. For God hears the cry of the afflicted when He gives
When he gives quietness, who then can make trouble? And when he hides his face, who then can see him, whether it is against a nation or a man alone, that the hypocrite should not reign, lest the people be ensnared? Final accusation, Job. By the way, has anyone told you you're a hypocrite in the last 20 minutes? And so, you know, he chimes in with that whole thing. Now he tells Job what he ought to do. For has anyone said to God, I have borne chastening, I will offend no more. Teach me what I do not see. If I have done iniquity, I will do no more. Should God repay it according to your terms? Just because you disavow it, you must choose and not I. Therefore, speak what you know. You say you're innocent, but you're not. You need to do what's right. Men of understanding, say to me, wise men who listen to me. So he's going to ask these three wise men now to join him in his denunciation of Job. Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without wisdom. Oh, that Job were tried to the utmost. In other words, what Job really needs is he needs to be tested even more. Why I ought to... I mean, you know, no comfort, because his answers are like those of a wicked man. A terrible accusation. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. And he hadn't done that. I mean, his conversations have been totally misrepresented. And moreover, Elihu answered and he said, do you think this is right? Do you say my righteousness is more than God's? And you know, Job had never, you know, said that. For you say, what advantage will it be to you? What profit shall I have more than if I had sinned? And he's addressing Job's complaint that he thought Job said, well, what good does it, you know, what good is it to follow God if this kind of stuff can happen to you? And so he's addressing that. He said, I'll answer you. And your companions with you. Look to the heavens and see and behold the clouds which are higher than you. If you sin, what do you accomplish against God? Or if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to Him? If you're righteous, what do you give to Him? Or what does He receive from your hand? Your wickedness afflicts a man such as you, and your righteousness a son of man. In other words, your sin doesn't affect God, it only affects you. Because of the multitude of oppressions, they cry out. They cry out for help because of the arm of the Almighty. But no one says, where is God my Maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth, and makes us wiser than the birds of heaven? There they cry out, but he does not answer, because of the pride of evil men. Job, God isn't answering you because he doesn't answer evil men. Ooh, all I can teach, I can't teach. No more. I mean, surely God will not listen to empty talk, nor will the Almighty regard it. That's why God's not listening to you. Although you say you do not see Him, yet justice is before Him, and you must wait for Him. And now, because He is not punished in His anger, nor taken much notice of folly, therefore Job opens his mouth in vain. He multiplies words without knowledge. And Elihu also proceeded and said, bear with me a little while. And, you know, there's one thing that you should never do is that when you're preaching, when you say you're finishing, finish. But when you say, now, finally, and in my in conclusion, and in my next to last conclusion, and in my almost final conclusion. So he keeps saying that he's going to complete here. He says, bear with me a little bit, and I'll show you that there are yet words to speak on God's behalf. I will fetch my knowledge from afar. I will ascribe righteousness to my Maker, for truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you. He's gone off the deep end. Gone off the deep end. Again, as I mentioned this morning, probably, you know, involved in a very intensive self-esteem curriculum in his youth in the public school system or whatever it might be there. He has a very high self-esteem, but it's unwarranted. It's unwarranted. It was interesting. Again, this happens every few years, but they redid it again. It was just about 2-3 weeks ago in the newspaper, where they took representatives of 6 Western industrialized nations, and they tested the students of those nations to come to conclusions concerning the educational system of those nations. The United States of America students, on average, placed in the 6th place of all of the 6 nations. We were the lowest. In fact, it's interesting, as was in the paper this last Sunday, that in the in Russia today, a Russian student graduating from the 6th grade has more science and more math than a high school graduate in the United States of America. That can't go on for very long, but that's another sermon, and I just got about 45 more seconds. But I'm not saying in conclusion just yet. So, but I know I'm provoking you to wrath. I'm going to provoke a riot here. But they then asked these students, they did a test to determine their self-esteem, and we finished number 1 as it relates to self-esteem. So we are in grave danger. We are making our students feel good about not producing or not excelling, and that's a dangerous place to be. And so here he is, he thinks he's the greatest, and you know, the only thing that's going to shut him down is God, and shortly, he said, "Behold, God is mighty, but despises no one. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not preserve the life of the wicked, but gives justice to the oppressed. He does not withdraw his eyes from the righteous, but they are on the throne with kings. For he has seated them forever, and they are exalted. And if they are bound in fetters, held in the cords of affliction, then he tells them their work and their transgressions, that they have acted defiantly. He also opens their ears to instruction, and he commands that they turn from iniquity. If they obey and serve him, they shall spend their days in prosperity and their years in pleasures. If they do not obey, they shall perish by the sword, and they shall die without knowledge." And so God is, you know, merciful in his purposes for man here. He says in verse 13, "But the hypocrites in heart store up wrath." This is how God reveals his almightiness towards the wicked. "They, in wrath, they do not cry for help when he binds them. They die in youth, and their life ends among the perverted persons. And he delivers the poor in their affliction and opens their ears in oppression. Indeed, he would have brought you out of dire distress into a broad or a safe place where there is no restraint. And what is set on your table would be full of richness, Job, but you're filled with the judgment due the wicked. Judgment and justice take hold of you, because there is wrath. Beware lest he take you away with one blow, for a large ransom would not help you avoid it. Will your riches or all the mighty forces keep you from distress, Job? Do you not desire the night when people are cut off in their place? Take heed and do not turn to iniquity, for you have chosen this rather than affliction. Behold, God is exalted by his power. Who teaches him? Who has assigned him his way? Or who has said, 'You have done wrong?'" Job, you need a fresh vision of God, and you need to start, you know, praising him and obeying him, and everything will be all right. Verse 24, "Remember to magnify his work." God is great, Job, "of which men have sung. Everyone has seen it. Man looks on it from afar. Behold, God is great, and we do not know him, nor can the number of his years be discovered, for he draws up drops of water, which distill as rain from the mist, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Indeed, can anyone understand the spreading of clouds, the thunder of his canopy? Look, He scatters his light upon it. He covers the depths of the sea, and by these he judges the peoples. He gives food in abundance. He covers his hands with lightning, and he commands it to strike. His thunder declares it, and the cattle also concerning the rising storm. God is almighty, Job, and he's almighty in nature. He's also almighty in creation. Chapter 37. At this also my heart. And as we head into chapter 37, I just want you to know we're not finishing the book tonight. I'm just finishing chapter 37. So, in conclusion, chapter 37. At this also my heart trembles and leaps from its place. And some of you are thinking, oh God, help them not to digress. Help just to read that chapter and get that thing done. Hear attentively the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. He sends it forth under the whole heaven, his lightning to the ends of the earth. After it, a voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain them when his voice is heard. God thunders marvelously with his voice. He does great things which we cannot comprehend. For he says to the snow, be on the earth, as it relates to winter. He says, likewise to the gentle rain and to the heavy rain of his strength. He seals the hand of every man, that all men may know his work. The animals enter into their dens, and in the harvest stop, as it relate to men. He's talking about the mightiness of God in the winter season. They remain in their lairs. From the chambers of the south comes the whirlwind, and cold from the scattering winds of the north. By the breath of God, ice is given, and the broad waters are frozen. Now he moves on to the spring. Also with moisture, he saturates the thick clouds. He scatters his bright clouds, and they swirl about, being turned by his guidance, that they may do whatever he commands them on the face of the whole earth. He causes it to come, whether for correction or for his land or for mercy. Listen to this, Job. Stand still and consider the wondrous works of God. And now he's going to talk about the summer season. Do you know when God dispatches them and causes the light of his cloud to shine? Do you know the balance of clouds? Those wondrous works of him who is perfect in knowledge? Why are your garments hot when he quiets the earth by the south wind? With him have you spread out the skies, Job, strong as a cast metal mirror? Teach us what we should say to him, Job, for we can prepare nothing because of the darkness. Should God be told that I wish to speak? If a man were to speak, surely he would be swallowed up. Even now, men cannot look at the light when it is bright in the skies. You can't look at the sun. You want to talk face to face with God. You can't even look at the sun. You know what you're asking for here. And the wind has passed and cleared them. He comes from the north as golden splendor, with God as awesome majesty. As for the Almighty, we cannot find him. He's excellent in power, in judgment and abundant justice. He does not oppress, and therefore men fear him. He shows no partiality to any who are wise of heart. And just when you thought that Elihu was never going to stop, and one gets the sense that he wasn't, he is going to probably, until the next meal, keep on going, God is going to interrupt him, and all of the speeches of man stop once God opens his, speaks in his voice in chapter 38. And this is one of the most fascinating passages of the entire Bible. What we head into next week is God answers all of them in their folly. And, maybe you've had the Lord do that to you at a time or two. Again, we look at Elihu and we kind of make fun of him a little bit. But again, there's an Elihu in each one of our hearts. And how many conversations? Have you ever been in a conversation where God stopped you? Where you, to save your life, you could not come up with the next thought. He just stopped you. Am I the only one that he sent that to? I mean,
I could write a book about the number of times that he's done that. But I mean, it's amazing. So it's the same thing. But here now, 37 chapters until we have reached the point where we don't want to hear what Job thinks. We don't want to hear what Elihu thinks. You don't want to hear me talk anymore. You don't want to hear what anybody else has. We don't want to hear anything but what God has to say, and that's just the point. He has painted the background now where we say, I don't want to hear anyone else but God. And God says, all right, here I come. And so often in our own lives, it's not until every other voice has been silenced, including our own, that then God says, by the way, you mind if I cut in here for a moment and say something that makes some sense.